This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
For the first time, U.S. subscribers can stream MLB Network 24/7, including select out-of-market games.
Swing and a drive. It's deep. It's gone. Yes!
Stream minor league affiliates.
Home run number one.
Or draft pick number one.
Plus, get MLB Big Inning and live audio for all 30 teams.
Baseball can't get better than this.
Experience the game like never before with MLB Network and At-Bat, your all-in-one baseball destination. Only $6.99 per month. Visit MLB.com/At-Bat for details. Blackout and other restrictions apply. MLB trademarks used with permission.
Play ball! It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Welcome back, everyone. This week, a conversation with Neil Walker, recently retired after a 12-year Major League career. Although you'll hear how hard that word, retire, actually is to say, given the decision wasn't entirely voluntary, more a circumstance of the game and the things every player has to deal with at some point. Walker had a very successful career, going from a first-round draft pick to playing second base for his hometown Pittsburgh Pirates, where he spent the bulk of his career. He later stopped in New York with both the Mets and the Yankees, and then briefly in Milwaukee, Miami, and Philadelphia. Walker was part of three playoff teams in Pittsburgh and one with the Yankees. His career arc is quite interesting because he grew up watching baseball in the steroid era, was drafted in the testing era, and saw his big league career play out through the analytic revolution in the StatCast era. Plus, he had the added perspective of being a second-generation big leaguer. Neil's father, Tom, was a pitcher in the 1970s who spent time with the Expos, Cardinals, Angels, and Tigers in parts of six major league seasons. All of that framework gives Neil Walker a really good perspective on how the game has changed and how it just got harder to be a hitter in the batter's box. Neil and I also spoke about the highs and lows of his career. And for Yankees fans, a few thoughts on his former Pirates teammates, Gerrit Cole and Jameson Taillon. And the Walkers have a wonderful and emotional connection to Roberto Clemente that many of you have probably heard. But if you haven't, or even if you have and you want to hear it again, please stick around for the end of this podcast as Neil recounts the magical details for us. It's truly a special story. Here is my conversation with Neil Walker. So, Neil, I guess the first thing off the bat is it's mid-April and you're not in a big league uniform for the first time in a long time. So your status as a big league player is what?
Yeah, my 12-plus seasons in the big leagues and, 7-plus seasons in the minor leagues are done. So, this is the first conversation I've had with media or with somebody that I've said that I'm done playing, and I kept in shape through spring training to kind of see if an opportunity might pop out of one of the camps if there was some injuries or so on and so forth, and that didn't happen. And so once opening day kind of rolled around, I kind of decided I'm good. So I feel like I've had a good run. I feel really fortunate to have played for some great organizations and in some great places, and so many good coaches and so many good teammates, and you just kind of reflect on what that all means to you in terms of a baseball career. So more than anything, I feel incredibly fortunate to have played the game at the highest level for as long as I did, and to be able to do things like play in my hometown for as long as I did and be a part of some really good teams in a lot of different stops. So I have no regrets in my career, and I feel really fortunate about that. And looking forward to the next chapter of my life. I have two young kids, and I found myself in the in the mornings in the line at school with the rest of the mom and dads, and that's certainly a change of pace, but it's something that I've kind of looked around and been like, yeah, I've been missing out on things like this, and I've been very fortunate. So I'm very, very, very happy with where I am right now.
It's funny, and I don't mean to make light of this, but I'll let you talk about this. You didn't say the R word. It's pretty hard. You're retired. How hard is it to actually say it?
Yeah, you know what? It's funny because you don't, at least for me, I haven't been avoiding it, but you know, most of the conversations I had up until, you know, I kind of set a soft deadline in my brain of like, okay, opening day. So April 1st, we'll call it. And as we're creeping towards there, people are kind of like, whoa, what's going to happen? And you're right though. I never wanted to be like, oh, you know, I'm retired. I'd always say like, well, I'll probably be done if we get to this point, or I don't know, we'll see, maybe something pops up in early April, but you know, so there, yeah, you're right. to say it is really to take that book and close it and put a lock on it. But like I said, I'm really fortunate of how things went in my career, and especially in comparison to you know, how long a lot of players are playing nowadays. It seems like the careers are kind of getting shorter and shorter, and not for really any other reason, most likely, than just you know, get caught kids starting early, pitchers starting earlier, and their arms kind of running out of gas by their early 30s, and the same thing on the hitting side. So I wouldn't change it for anything else. So yes, I am retired.
A few days ago, a guy that you spent a lot of time competing against, I think through the minors even too, and then into the majors in the same division, Jay Bruce called it. Yeah. I just wonder how hard it is to know that you played consistently every day for a long time, and there's a competition aspect to it, and there's a, you know, personal aspect to it of putting up numbers, and you both did that to a certain degree for a very long time, and it's a pretty sudden halt. You know, it's the game tell. You know, I use this expression with, and I'm talking about Jay Bruce. I use this expression. The game told him he wasn't good enough anymore. And it's a lot different than, you know, being a Hall of Famer who says, you know what, I'm good. I got everything I could. I had a great career. I'm walking away. Right. You guys both had really good careers. But the game told you in different ways that you weren't good enough anymore. How hard is that realization to set in?
Yeah, it's, for me, that process really started the offseason that I signed with the Yankees, and not that I had any big grandiose ideas of getting this long-term contract. At that point, I played year to year. I went through 4 years of arbitration. I always felt like I had the carrot dangling out in front of me as far as 1 year contracts are concerned, and I think that kind of kept me pushing in the right direction and challenging myself. And then I come over to the Yankees, and fortunately for me, I was put in a really good position to essentially be playing every time there was a righty on the mound, whether it was first, second, third, and even bouncing the outfield a little bit. But that mindset really in early, and obviously my first month and a half, and I signed late that year, and my first month and a half with the Yankees were hard because, you know, in my brain, I was like, okay, well, I won't be playing as much. I'll figure this thing out. But when you're going through your day to day and you're trying to figure out how to keep yourself sharp, you haven't gone through that, so you don't know. And all of a sudden you're playing on a Monday and there's three lefties in a row and you're not playing again till Thursday or Friday, and you're stepping the box and you're like, wow, my timing is really messed up. And then you go through this whole process of trying different things with your routine and during the game, and eventually it comes around. But for me, it took a month and a half, and I was fortunate enough to be able to work through that. But you kind of understand and know where that's coming from. And you're getting, sometimes you get to the age where, you know, if the Yankees, especially that year, were like, hey, we want you to play 7 days a week. In my brain, I would have been like, well, okay, I've had a back surgery a couple of years ago. I've had some quad injury, hamstring injury. I'll do the best I can. But you know, and to hit off another piece that you said, I kind of call it the back of the baseball card theory, right? You know, and that's, are you getting the bulk of a bats? If you do get the fortune, if you are fortunate enough to get those everyday at bats as a, you know, first, second, third year player and solidify yourself in a lineup and on a roster, you know where you're going to be for the most part if you're giving yourself 500 to 650 at bats or plate appearances, right? Outside of injury or some kind of unforeseen thing that keeps you out of everyday at bats, you know, you look at the back of my baseball card, it's pretty much, you know, 250 to 280 with, you know, this, you know what I mean? So, and then you get to the point where you're not playing as much and you have to kind of change your role and you have to be more adaptive, and you basically try to hang on as long as you can, because the sport, like you're saying, is telling you, hey, look, you know, you're still valuable, but you're not as valuable as you once were. So if you can do this role to the best of your ability and still be successful doing it, then you're going to be able to bounce around and hang on. And then, you know, it might get to the point where it just doesn't make sense for you anymore. And like with Jay, I actually spoke with Jay, and I actually lived with Jay last year when I was with the Phillies. Hmm. We our families weren't there, so we spent a lot of time. And I had been getting to the point where it was like, you know, I was just kind of hanging on, and I was just trying to be, you know, a cog with the Phillies last year. And when my role changed, when they changed the rules to full on DH last year, it really hurt me because I was going to be relied upon with the Phillies to bounce around a little bit. Well, offensively, they're set up as so that basically they have 7 of 8 guys in the lineup that never come out of the lineup. So I was given the unfortunate job of when somebody needed a break off of Max Scherzer or Jacob DeGrom, I was the guy to be thrown in there at first base or third base or whatever. And I was perfectly fine with that. But that's when you kind of realize that things are going in the direction. And with Jay, and I certainly don't want to speak for him, but I know he was kind of getting to the point where he was feeling like he had kind of accomplished everything at the major league level. And he had, same thing as me, 2 young kids at home and, you know, 13, 14 years in the big league. So I guess to a degree, he probably just kind of hit his breaking point mentally, and, you know, hats off to him. He was an amazing guy to play against, an amazing guy to play with. And so fortunate to get to know him, especially at the end of his career and play with him.
You ended up basically living out, I think, a dream come true, right? I mean, you know, you played 12 years in the big leagues, and as I said, this is a really good career. It's over 1,300 games with 6 different teams. You hit 267 over that stretch. You won a Silver Slugger, but you're a Pittsburgh kid. You grew up in Pittsburgh, and I remember a campaign that TBS used to have when they were promoting Braves games. They used to say, "Where were you when Sid slid?" You know, you were 7 years old when Sid slid, yeah, and broke your heart. Yeah. And then all those years later, when the Pirates finally came back, you're on the field. There's 40,000 people at PNC Park for the 2013 wildcard game, and you go 2 for 5, and you're helping the Pirates win a playoff game and advance in a playoff series. You know, what does that feel like for a kid who grew up where you did?
Well, I can tell you that when Sid Bream slid into home, and actually Sid Bream lives around in this area still, in the Pittsburgh area, and you'll see him every once in a while. And every time I see him, I just kind of like, I give this, because I literally was with my 2 brothers and sister watching the game in my living room. I can remember it like it was yesterday, and just bawling my eyes out as a 7-year-old kid.
Wow.
And, you know, at that time, I played so much front yard baseball with my older brothers and knew it even at that time that I wanted to be a major league player. So, you know, my crusade basically started before that. But getting into high school, I remember things like Sean Casey hitting the first home run at PNC Park in 2001 and being so mad. I was like a sophomore in high school or something like that, and I wasn't able to be at that game, and I was supposed to be because one of my games got moved around. And so I was a fan. I was a huge fan growing up. I was a huge fan in high school. And then all of a sudden I get to my senior year and it looks like I'm falling in this range in the first round that the Pirates might be in, and get drafted by them, go through the whole minor league process, get to the big leagues. We're essentially a 100-loss team 3-4 years in a row. They're kind of trying to throw pieces together. Andrew McCutchen was drafted the year after me. When we kind of moved up and got to AAA, we started to get a little more talented. We both got to the big leagues in 2009. 10 was tough in Pittsburgh. 11 was tough. All of a sudden we get to 12 and we start to put some more pieces around, and Andrew and I are solidifying ourselves as everyday players. And we start to win some games. And that particular year we fizzled out at the end of the year. And going into that 13 season, we were like, wow, I think we have something here. We have some pretty good pitching. They supplemented us with really good veteran players and good veteran presence guys to help us young guys develop and continue to learn how to win. And here, there we are in late September of 2013, and we're like, wow, we're going to the playoffs. We were in a tough division with St. Louis, and I think Chicago that year was still really competitive. So we didn't win the division, but played in that, or it was Cincinnati. I'm sorry, obviously Cincinnati, and playing in that wild card game, it really was like a culmination of what was 20 years of losing, of team not even being over 500, and to be a part of that. I remember we clinched to go over 500 against the Texas Rangers. I think we in mid September, Yu Darvish was pitching, I think, and we won and Garrett Cole, I believe, was pitching, and we won like a 1-0 game, and I remember the last out came to me and I threw it to first and I said, give me the ball. and I got the ball back and guys were like, great. We just won a game. And my teammates was like, why did you want that ball after the game? And I said, you realize that this is a symbol of the last 20 years of under 500 baseball. Obviously, in the grand scheme of things, and you as somebody that covers the Yankees and being like that type of stuff is not really important. But you want it now. You want the championship now, right? But in Pittsburgh, it had been such a long haul that those 20 years just kind of culminated in that 2013 season, and going into the playoffs, winning that series was incredible to be a part of that. And we lose to St. Louis in game five of the division series. And we still really felt like we were moving in the right direction and had a really good team. And obviously 14 and 15 were great years. And we were in tough divisions and had, two guys, Arrieta and Baumgartner, that really threw well against us in wild card games. And so it was just incredible to see how the community rallied around, though, just to go to the grocery store or to go places, go out to eat. People were so far on board. And as a Steeler fan and somebody that understands kind of that side of it too, because, Steelers football is like Yankees baseball in this region, right? Like, if things are good, they're great. If things are in between or bad, they're horrible, right, in the minds of fans. So you got a sense of that on the baseball side of things, and it was incredibly special and something that I took a lot of pride in, and my teammates didn't quite understand it because they didn't quite understand the backstory per se. Yeah. They just knew like, oh, we haven't been very good for a while. And I was like, a while? I mean, there's a couple guys in the team that weren't even alive the last time that we had a winning season. So really, really special.
I'm just picturing you strutting around Giant Eagle with that shopping cart right now. That's pretty good. I'm sorry. I guess in Pittsburgh it's pronounced John Eagle. I don't, I need to make sure I get that right.
Yeah.
Hey, did you ever feel like, you played with some big market teams, but you spent a majority of your career in Pittsburgh, and that window was short, I guess, in the grand scheme, but it was a pretty good window of opportunity for you guys. You won 94 games one year, you won 98 another year. Did you feel like the deck was stacked against you as players and as a team because of the whole major league system and the payrolls you're up against? Or did you feel like, cyclically you were now in a window where you had the chance and you had the players to do it?
Yeah, I kind of feel like it's a little bit of both, right? So, obviously the way the system is set up in baseball, the bigger your market, the bigger your TV deals are, your bigger your fan base, you're going to be able to afford bigger name players in Pittsburgh and in places like Pittsburgh, at least right now, you're not really able to do that. So you're really dependent on the development of players in the minor league system, and then supplementing those guys with the right veteran pieces to come in, whether it's on a short term or long term. And we knew that you knew that in Pittsburgh, and we felt like there was a window where the core was essentially, myself, Andrew McCutchen, Starling Marte, and Gregory Polanco, and we supplemented guys like A.J. Burnett and Russell Martin, and Garrett Cole was very young at the time coming up. And you're looking around and you're like, wow, there's not many holes in this team. And we're essentially playing under the Tampa Bay Ray and Oakland model. And it can work, and it has worked in the past. And you have to have a lot of things go right. You have to have a lot of health. You have to have guys that everybody basically pulling their weight and playing at their numbers to kind of give yourself that opportunity, because, you know, you're not able to go out there and get the and throw the $100 million contracts at guys. And that's just the way baseball's set up. And a part of you as a player feels like you wish that there was a way to completely even the score, but it's just not how it's set up. And, you know, as players, you're fighting for the free agency. You're fighting for your rights as a player to make that big contract when you get through your arbitration years. And guys a lot of times don't get to that point. And then you have guys, the Garrett Coles of the world and Trevor Bowers and some of these guys that are getting huge contracts. So you hope that that at the end of the day, and as this thing moves closer to this new bargaining agreement and even past that baseball, the owners and the teams and the players are able to find a way to kind of bridge that gap to figure out a way to not incentivize some of these teams to be on the very, very bottom of the spectrum, because they want the first, second, third pick of the draft, right? And that's something that's in my opinion is really important for the game moving forward, because you hate to see essentially 12 teams in the league that are really going for it, and the other 18 teams not really going for it. And there's just so many, in my opinion, there's so few teams that are living in the middle nowadays, right? Yeah. There's so many teams, and there's a domino effect with this, right? And and anybody that watches the offseason sees that, okay, why there's players that are kind of in the middle that aren't getting what maybe they should, and why are they still sitting there? And you go, well, because the teams at the top have already kind of poached the players that have basically gotten 50% of what they thought they would get to this point. Yeah. And then everybody else that's kind of taking the table scraps per se are ending up, they don't want to end up with a rebuilding team, whether it's a 1 year, 2 year deal or whatever they might get. So you wish there was a way to not incentivize, but not punish teams that aren't necessarily going for it, but at least teams that are giving themselves shots and living somewhat in the middle. And a lot of people will say, well, that's stupid. I mean, why would you want to live in the middle? Well, you know, we don't know there's obviously the league is pushing for more teams in the playoffs and more opportunities for teams to just get yourself in the playoffs. And that's really all you want as a player is that opportunity, because anything can happen once you get in the playoffs. So we'll see where it goes from there. But more than that, you know, baseball is still so much fun to watch when you're seeing every single guy that pitches basically throwing 95 to 100. Yeah. And, you know, the Aaron Judges of the world hitting all these home runs and so on and so forth. You know, it's exciting, but I think, you know, hopefully there's a way to continue to move it in the right direction.
You know, you just actually great transition to what I wanted to ask you about next. Your career is a wonderful arc for thinking about where the game is right now. You started in 2009 and you finished in 2020. Hitting got a lot harder in that stretch, it feels like. At least the numbers bear it out, and everybody who talks about it says it's just harder now. Just focusing in on that one aspect of it, how did it change from the time you broke in to the time you finished?
Well, when I'm asked that similar question, in my brain, this is how it goes. You know, in 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, essentially, if you were going into a series, if you play three game, four game, whatever it may be, there was a good chance that what you were going to see from the starter was sinker, slider, changeup, right? And they wanted you to hit the ball on the ground. They wanted you to make quick outs. They weren't concerned about pitch counts for the most part if guys were throwing strikes, and it was easier to put the ball in play, right? Get into 14, 15, 16, you're seeing more guys throwing four seamers at the top of the zone, cutters, you know, basically that downward X has moved almost to a sideways or upward X, right? And it became more difficult to hit because guys are essentially, they're trying to lift the ball. They're trying to get the ball in the air. Whereas early in my career, 9, 10, 11, 12, it was like, okay, this guy's going to sink the ball away from you. Let's eliminate trying to hit the ball, to pull the ball. Let's stay in the middle of the field to the opposite field, make him throw strikes, make him get the ball up. And you knew that if you stayed with that approach, you were going to be pretty good because there wasn't guys throwing 95 to 97 mile an hour sinkers. You know, there were guys, everybody was, every single chart you looked at was, you know, and Derek Lowe always comes to my brain, like 89 to 92 sinker, you know, 84 to 87 mile an hour slider, 82 to 84 mile an hour changeup, right? It was just common across the board. And then it became, well, did that guy keep the ball down that night and throw strikes? Well, it's just not like that anymore. And when you're watching the game now and you see balls at the top of the zone, breaking balls over the top, cutters, you know, two seamers that are running off the plate and everything being at top of the zone, and it's foul ball, strikeout, walk, you know, it makes, you can just tell that it's just a much different philosophy. And whether it's right or wrong, I think we're in a spot now where it's going to be like this for a little while. And I'm convinced that it'll probably start turning back the other direction. You may start seeing the loogies come back, right? And the lefty specialists that are throwing 82 to 86, but they're spotting the ball and they're getting guys out in front, because in my opinion, it's less about covering, you know, 90, 94 to 99 on a daily basis, and more about, you know, staying in the strike zone and hitting strikes and being able to hit balls at the top of the zone. You know, for so long, guys were not, you know, not really taught to hit balls at the top of the zone. Now they're working on that. They're trying to figure out ways to cover that. So, you know, it's really interesting. But like you said, I feel like I was fortunate enough to see kind of a lot of different aspects in my time in the big leagues. And I saw that evolution, and you felt it coming, and you had to try to adapt. And I think the guys that did a better job of adapting to that, and in my brain, my walks went up as my career went on, because I understood that guys were trying to get you to expand your zone. And so, you know, my strikeouts went up as my career went on, but my walks also went up because you had to be more cognizant of how you were being pitched. And it was less about expanding down early in my career and more about expanding up. And you just had to understand that it's just more difficult to hit velo at the top of the zone than it is, you know, laying off sliders and breaking balls in the dirt, in my opinion.
I think another thing, and I just looked this up to confirm it, that really changed how the game is played. And it makes me think, like, this just isn't the same game. And I think that's what's really hard for everybody to understand. Your numbers went significantly up the third time you faced a pitcher versus the first time you faced them, and the fourth as well. So now you're at a point where, you know, you're not facing the same guy four times in a game. This is completely different. And as much as we like to compare eras, and I mean, and you're as good a guy at that as anybody because you have a father who played in the big leagues in a different era. So as much as we like to compare that, it feels to me like just looking at that particular aspect of it, like how a hitter does facing a pitcher the third and fourth time, and the fact that never happens anymore, it's almost not fair, because this is not the same game to me, Neil.
Yeah, and you see a lot of kind of surviving and it, with guys in the box. When I watch the game and not being an everyday player over the course of the last couple of years, I got a front row seat to just kind of see how guys are approaching. And like I said, you have a lot of pitchers now that are just 95 to 100, and they're just going to challenge you until you can prove that you can hit it, right? But during my part of my career, it was like I was saying, here's your sinker, here's your slider, here's your changeup. You know, we're going to work in, out, up, down, try to set you up as a pitcher. And you started to learn, like you were saying, over when you're facing a guy two, three, four, five times over the course of a season, over the course of a career, the pattern was very similar, because guys were going to live and die by their best stuff and try to keep the ball down and so on and so forth. Well, in my opinion, and nowadays, you know, guys like like Tyler Glasnow, they can just, and Garrett Cole, they can just completely dominate you with three pitches in three upper 90s fastballs. And there's not as much setting guys up nowadays as maybe there was. And this is not that long ago. And not that it's right or wrong, but it changes your philosophy. And I found myself having a harder time toward the end of my career really diving into an approach basically for that reason, because I used to always feel like my first at bat against a guy or during a game, if I saw every one of their pitches, if he was a three pitch guy or a four pitch guy, if I was somehow able to see all three or all four of his pitches in my first at bat, it was going to make my second and third bat much easier and much easier to approach. And that pretty much stuck true until this evolution started to occur and guys were throwing so much harder. And it basically became, okay, I need to cover 95 plus, but also understand that he's got a 75 mile an hour curveball. And so I just need to be good in certain spots of the zone and not expand. And so that mindset completely changed. And you stepped into the box and you said, if I get a 95 mile an hour heater right down the middle of the plate right here, I don't want to be late, because he may elevate that a little bit more the next pitch and it might be foul ball and it's 0-2. And I haven't even seen any of his other pitches. And so that's kind of how my mindset worked as my career went along. It almost went to a survival mode. And, wow. And of course there could be so many different aspects of that, me slowing down as a player and all of that. So I'm very cognizant of that too. But at the same time, you know, you see guys getting, you know, much more overpowered nowadays, in my opinion, because of the stuff that guys have now and how hard they throw. And there's much less setting guys up and coming in, out, up, down. It's go after them until they can prove that they can handle your stuff.
No such thing as hitter's counts is things that I've heard a lot lately. Like that's right. Old familiar patterns they're all gone.
Right.
Listen, you're a good guy to ask about this, I think, because you like the game still, you mentioned. There are a lot of different innovations people are talking about, and they're trying out at the independent and minor league levels, a lot of different things that they're trying to just bring more action into the game. It's harder because, as you said, they're trying not to let you hit the ball, and that really takes a lot of the action out of the game. What's something – is there any of the – are there any of the proposed changes or things that they're experimenting with, like moving the mound back or bigger bases or things that they're doing to try to get people to run more? Are there any of those that you've kind of latched on to and said, yeah, you know what, that's a really good idea? Or is there something else that you've thought of that you'd think would help the game moving forward?
Yeah, you know, I'm not a big proponent for messing with the distance on the mound. I think that's an aspect of the game where guys have to adapt as hitters and pitchers. I'd hate to see that happen, because I feel like that would even a small amount, you would see, you know, guys having issues, you know, trying to add velocity and things like that, and it would lead maybe to more injuries. And I like the bases being a little bigger, that, you know, you see a couple injuries every year of guys slipping over bases and things like that. So to have a bigger base and a much lower base and kind of those things, I like that. I've always had a soft spot in my heart, and I'm not even a pitcher, but I've always had a soft spot for when, you know, you're playing in extra innings and all of a sudden the game goes 17, 18 innings. And some poor kid that has options left that was up. Yeah. It's July. He's been up for the entire season to that point. The poor guy sucks up four innings and he's gone for 3 weeks. And you're like, man, he drew a short straw. So yes. I'm not totally convinced that the extra inning rules of starting a guy on second base is necessarily the right thing. But I do also think that the steamroll effect of the whole thing, whether it's like, you know, start a guy on first base I don't know. I haven't spent enough time kind of thinking about it. And it is nice, you know, because most of these games now are not going more than 10, 11, 12 innings at the most, just because of how it's set up. But at the same time, you're like, oh, you know, there was a guy in second. you had three shots to get a base hit and score a guy.
Yeah.
And if your pitcher comes out the next inning and strikes two guys out and gets a fly ball, you win. You know, did you really work to get that win? So, but I am super sensitive to the fact that you know, the way baseball is set up, especially for the reliever types, that, you know, guys just get screwed all the time from those, you know, two games in a row where you play 12 innings one night and 15 innings the next, and all of a sudden you have four new pitchers in your bullpen.
Yeah.
And sometimes those guys come up and pitch better than the guys that went down, and they don't even get back up, and you're like, oh man, that sucks. So and there's a lot of different things that are kind of being worked on that I think are pretty helpful, and I am on board with the trying to figure out a way to speed the game up. So that's probably the first and foremost thing that I would like to see, because especially now as a fan, and I watch a lot of the MLB Network games and the Pirate games as a local guy, and you're turning around in the fifth inning on most nights, and it's two and a half hours plus, and you're just like, oh my gosh, you know, and you're thinking about, I have a 4-year-old and I took her down to opening day for the Pirates, and it was great, but you get to the fourth inning and your kid's running around all the play, and you're like, well, you know, if it was the seventh inning, you might be able to stick it out for the next couple of minutes, but it's the fourth inning. And I think a lot of fans have that same reaction. They want to go to games. They want to sit down and watch an entire ball game, but you know, it's becoming increasingly harder. So,
yeah, with the, I'm with you on the extra innings thing. I kind of like it just because, for what you said, one of the big reasons, a guy who gives up a walk-off homer on the first pitch will keep his job in the big leagues. He'll still be there the next day. The guy who threw four scoreless gets his pay cut 80% and sent back to AAA. And you know, that's the inequity there. And I like that it spurs action, because a lot of times, even though we like the romanticism of 16, 17 inning games, there's a lot of nothing happening for an extra hour and a half. And I think we all just want to see something happen. So I want to tailor a couple things, one to a New York audience and one to your Pittsburgh audience, actually more of a national audience. But the New York audience knows that they need Garrett Cole and Jameson Taillon to be very good this year. You know them both pretty well. What can you tell Yankee fans about what – I think they know a little more certainty what they see in Cole, but your experiences with him and maybe what you think Jameson Taillon is capable of.
Well, Garrett is one of my best friends, not even as a baseball player, but as a person, and we spend a lot of time talking to one another, and we've gone on many family trips together. Our wives are really good friends, and so I can tell you that this guy cares probably more than he should. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but this guy is just be off the charts competitive. His first week in the big leagues, I mean, this guy was in the dugout on the top step in his cleats, just in case, you know, the game went extra innings or the pitcher got knocked out early and they needed a hitter to not burn a bench guy. You know what I mean? That's the type of guy he is. He's so cerebral. He understands the game. He understands his arsenal on what the things he does well, the things he doesn't do well, and he cares so much. And I always get a kick out of when he's pitching and he essentially strikes out the side, and the last guy the third out, he strikes guy out, and it looks like he's mad at himself because he didn't hit his spot, but he still blew a guy away with 97. And I'm always shaking my head like, just go back in the dugout. You know what I mean? Go back in the dugout. Get your drink of water and go back out there. Like, you're one of the best pitchers this game has seen in a long time, and you're so impressive. But you don't have to be as perfect as you're trying to be. But that's his personality. That's his character. And I hope that the Yankee fans appreciate it. And with J-Mo, he and Garrett are so close too, and he's really rubbed off on Garrett has really rubbed off on J-Mo over his years, and his arsenal is really, really impressive too. And I think that he's still kind of working his way back. These injuries have been something that have I think been more of a mental piece for him to get over. But this is a guy that has front of the rotation type of stuff and can get a lot of outs. And I think that as his pitch count continues to grow and his arsenal continues to get sharper, you're going to see this guy getting better as the season goes along. And outside of any, you know, any sort of health issue, you guys have got yourself, the Yankees have got themselves a not a diamond in the rough per se, because he was so good in Pittsburgh, but you know, it's been, it was stop go for the last 3-4 years for this guy, just because of his injury. So my hope for him is that he's able to stay healthy, because a full season in 20, 25, 30 starts for this guy is a good thing for this for the Yankees organization.
All right. And one more, I mentioned this is really for the Pittsburgh people, but I think it's more for the national people. And I know this story has been told a lot, but I'm going to take a chance that there are a few people listening who haven't really heard the full version of it. You know, you grew up in Pittsburgh. You were born, 13 years after Roberto Clemente passed away, right?
Yep.
But I'm not exaggerating. You literally owe your life to Roberto Clemente because of the interactions between him and your father, who was a pitcher in the 70s. Would you, I just like hearing you guys tell the story. Would you mind telling it for people who might not have heard it, the connection between Roberto, your father, and you?
Sure. Yeah. And you know, obviously the story of Roberto's plane going down in Puerto Rico is, you know, well documented. Anybody that's a baseball fan knows that story. But my dad was actually playing in Puerto Rico at that time. And, you know, the earthquake in Nicaragua happened in December of that year. And, you know, guys around the league, it was going into New Year's, and guys around that Puerto Rican Winter League said, you know, Roberto had said, "Hey, I'm going to put a plane together. We're going to throw some goods in this plane, and we're going to go." And there were, you know, some guys that said, "Hey, well, you know, you're just going to go and come back. It's just a day trip. Why don't we go with you? You know, we don't have girlfriends. We don't have wives. We're here by ourselves. We're not playing. We have off between Christmas and New Year's." And my dad was one of those guys. And you know, him telling the story of him getting to the airport and loading this plane, and Roberto basically going, "Well, hey guys, this plane is too full." And they were like, "No, we'll sit on boxes. We'll, no big deal. We'll play some cards. We'll drink some beers, you know, no big deal." And him being adamant to, like, you know, "No, this is, it's just gonna be me and the pilot. It's New Year's, go back and celebrate." And that plane taking off and going down, and literally my dad being at the airport along with several other players, and Roberto not allowing those guys to get on the plane has saved my life. And, you know, fast forward, there were just some things that were crazy to me. And Roberto, his name, it was Roberto Clemente Walker, right? He used the Walker name, which, you know, you don't really see it typically anywhere, but you see it on his bust at Cooperstown and some of those things. My dad's name is Robert Thomas Walker.
Yeah.
So his first name, he goes by Tom, but his first name is Robert Walker. So that's weird. And, you know, once I got to the big leagues and we started to have Clemente Day around the league, but in Pittsburgh, it was obviously a little more special. The Clementes would come into town, the boys and Vera would come into town, and we'd go to local schools and we would, you know, promote the game of baseball, but also teach the story of Roberto Clemente and his humanitarianism and everything that he stood for and everything that he did for not just baseball, but the Latin community, and at a time in history where there was still a lot of sensitivity toward with racism and so on and so forth. He was so integral to everything that's going on in the game right now and in society in general. And to see guys on a daily basis in the big leagues and how much they appreciate not just the Latin culture, but what Roberto stands for is something that really warms my heart. And I was so lucky. I mean, I got a 21, I'm playing for the Pirates. I got a 21 foot wall in right field. And I get to run out of the dugout at third base and go over there. And there wasn't many days that I wouldn't be standing for the national anthem and think to myself, "Holy cow, like, I am so lucky to not just be here, but to have my path of getting to the big leagues, to be a part of this organization with my connection to my dad." And probably the culmination of the whole story for me personally, and set aside my dad's relationship, Clemente Day, 2014, I believe, September, and I'm sitting on 20 home runs. We're playing the Boston Red Sox on Clemente Day. I think my second or third at bat, I hit a home run just over the 21-foot wall for my 21st home run of the season on Clemente Day.
Yeah.
And no joke. I mean, people can tell you when you hit a home run, you're usually not thinking anything. You're excited. You're proud. You're running around the bases. I hit that thing and it just barely got over and I hit first base and I have goosebumps now just telling the story, but I hit first base and I have goosebumps and I come into the dugout and players understand this too. They were like, oh my gosh, Vera was just in the dugout before the first inning. His boys were in here. They're going, you just hit your 21st home run. And if you don't believe in supernatural or whatever you want to call it, a higher being, I had never felt more like I had, you know, Roberto Clemente was with me on that day. And I felt like he was with me every day. I took the field at PNC Park and, you know, my dad gets extremely emotional every time he tells a story. And us in the family have heard that story so many times. So we're numb to it, but to see people's reaction that have never heard the story is really incredible. So you're absolutely right. I owe my entire life, and that's weird to say, but I owe my entire life to Clemente, and I'll never stop being somebody that supports getting his number retired completely across the league. I think that's really important. I think that this is a guy that any player should mold his game after if they have the ability to. And I couldn't be more prouder to have played for the Pirates organization and to be in the same organization that Roberto Clemente came up in.
And that's exactly why I wanted you to tell the story again.
Thank you. You're welcome.
My thanks again to Neil Walker, as well as his father, Tom, who I got to meet a couple of years back. It was a thrill for me to tell Tom that his was one of the first baseball cards I can remember owning when I was a kid back in the 1970s. And if you want to hear more about that relationship between the Walkers and the Clementes, go check out the Talking 21 podcast with Danny Torres. Both Neil and Tom discussed that at more length in a recent episode of that podcast that is dedicated to the memory of Roberto Clemente. Neil Walker will find himself in the game again at some point, whether it's as a coach or a broadcaster or whatever. Someone who has the deep connection to the game and still enjoys it as a fan and a viewer is exactly who should have a say in moving the game forward. If you're new here, please check out the 30 with Murdy archive. My recent conversations have included another Pittsburgh great, Dave Parker, who talks about his life in his new book, Cobra. You might also enjoy a conversation with John Odell from the Baseball Hall of Fame about the 1981 baseball card explosion that changed the entire hobby forever. Please make sure to hit subscribe and review and all that jazz. And until next time, I'm Sweeney Murdy. Thanks for listening.
In the fast-paced world of attacking, speed is everything. And that's where the Furon 7 Plus shines. Engineered for accuracy and precision at a rapid pace, it's your secret weapon on the pitch. Experience overall comfort and precise striking, even in the game's fastest moments. The nylon outsole, with its V-shaped stud configuration, is designed for firm ground, giving you the grip you need to outmaneuver your opponents. Step up your attacking game and learn more and purchase the Furon at NewBalance.com.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
It's a good thing baseballs already have stitches, because the way these ball players are hitting them, yeah, they'd need stitches if they didn't already have them. So the next time you're watching a poor little baseball smacked off the wall in center, keep that little fella in your thoughts. It's hard to be a baseball right now. Baseball is something else. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.